You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Coming up, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced that the Senate would delay the vote on the Republicans' health care bill. We'll talk about that news and the Congressional Budget Office report released yesterday.
First, the Supreme Court gave the green light yesterday for parts of President Trump's travel ban to go into effect. The full ban, which targeted six Muslim-majority nations, will be considered by the Supreme Court in the fall.
The court has allowed a scaled-back version of the president's immigration policy to go into effect, but critics still say that it is discriminatory and functions as a de facto ban on Muslims. But on Twitter, President Trump said he was grateful for the Supreme Court's decision, adding, quote, "We must keep America safe."
Hiroshi Motomura is a professor at the UCLA School of Law. He focuses on immigration and citizenship. He joins us now for a look at the future of the travel ban. Hiroshi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, the key word here in this ruling for now seems to be partial. And what does that mean? How many people are going to be affected now that part of the travel ban is in place?
Well, that's a great and really central question, because the court, on the one hand, allowed part of the ban to go into effect, but it created a huge exception. In other words, that the ban is still blocked as to a lot of people. And what the court said is that the ban can't be applied to foreign nationals with a bona fide relationship with an individual or an entity in the United States. And that is a huge number of people who would have been affected by the ban. And so in that sense, if it's a partial victory for the executive order, it's really just a fraction of what I think the president was trying to accomplish.
Right. Let's look at who would have been covered under the full ban and is not now covered under that restriction you just mentioned of having that connection with someone in the United States. What kind of categories of people now can come here that couldn't have under the full ban?
Well, you know, the phrase bona fide relationship with an individual or entity in the United States, could be very vague. And I think there's going to be some areas where it is going to have to be litigated in a lot of gray areas. And it'll create a great deal of uncertainty in those gray areas. But one thing the court did, which I think was very helpful, is it listed some examples what the court thought would be clearly qualifying as having a bona fide relationship with a U.S. individual or entity. So to answer your question, one thing is immigrants sponsored by U.S. citizens or permanent residents. So that would be one example. Another is non-citizens who've accepted a job offer from a U.S. employer. Another example is non-citizens admitted to U.S. educational institutions to study. Another is non-citizens invited to speak to U.S. audiences. And interestingly, it took a pretty broad view of this in saying that, giving as an example, people who are coming essentially to visit, really on tourist visas, visit relatives in the United States. And so when you think about the number of people who come to this country, so many people who come to this country really need a connection with a U.S. employer or with a relative anyway, or with an educational institution because they've been admitted. And so in this sense, while there's a lot of gray area, and I think there are a lot of aspects of the ban that are still troubling to a lot of people, numerically, the ban doesn't cover anywhere near the number of people that I think the executive order was originally going to cover.
One possible gray area is a refugee who wants to come to the United States who has a relationship with a refugee resettlement organization. Does that count as the kind of relationship that would exempt someone from the ban?
Well, that's the kind of thing that, you know, I think that it really depends on how courts, other courts, lower courts, construe what it means to have this relationship, right? It's a bona fide relationship with a U.S. entity or a citizen. Now, it turns out a lot of refugees who are settled in the United States actually do have relatives here. So we know from what the court said that those folks would be allowed in. And the court was very clear that this is going to go this can go above the lowered cap that the executive order, you know, the executive order tried to cut the number of refugees admitted this year and a little bit under half of the original amount. And so you've got a situation where a lot of these refugees have relatives here, and so they'll be exempt from the ban. The question you raise is, you know, what happens if it's a refugee resettlement agency? Well, I mean, I'm not sure why the court would have used the phrase entity in that context if it weren't, you know, having in mind some of these agencies. So my thought here is that it should qualify, but I think the courts will have the final word on this, of course. And this is another one of these areas. I mean, give you another gray area. The court talked about close relatives or family members of the United States. I'm not sure exactly how the court said that, the Supreme Court. I'm not sure how lower courts will construe that. But you know, I think it's really significant that the court, the Supreme Court, reached beyond what you have to do to sponsor someone. In other words, like, you, for example, you can be sponsored by a citizen spouse. Spouse is a U.S. citizen. They can sponsor you. That's clearly qualified or clearly covered by the protection of the injunction. In other words, the travel ban won't apply to them. You know, you cannot get sponsored to this country by a grandparent, for example. But, you know, the court's language seems to suggest that it's not just the person who can sponsor you, but it's a wider circle of relatives. But this is another gray area. So I think the refugee one is a gray area. I think that the scope of relatives is a gray area. And I think the refugee example you gave is a bona fide relationship with a U.S. entity. But, you know, it's the courts will have to sort that out, and I think they're going to have to sort it out pretty soon because these cases are going to come up. You know, if I could just take a second to give you a kind of a more conceptual answer here. I think the court here was really concerned. The Supreme Court was really concerned about hurting people in the United States, companies, individuals, universities, et cetera. And so, one of the things here is one of the ways to understand what it means to have a bona fide relationship with a citizen or entity inside the United States is, you know, is there someone who's being hurt? He can make a claim and can sue that their mission is hurt or their family life is hurt. And, you know, I think that ought to be the way the courts construe it. But I'd be the first to admit to you that there's a lot of ambiguity in the phrase bona fide relationship, even though the court, I think, was very helpful in providing some examples of this.
Hiroshi Motomura is with us from UCLA's School of Law, looking at the Supreme Court and the president's travel ban. A couple of constitutional issues at stake here when it comes to how the country handles immigration. One of them is, how much latitude does the president, the administration, have to stop immigration from, in this case, selected countries for national security reasons? Did we learn anything about the Supreme Court's attitude toward that from what we saw yesterday?
A little bit. It's hard to say. I mean, we know that three justices wrote a separate opinion that expressed their view that the president really ought to have a huge amount of latitude. And so they, those three justices seem to take a view of very strong presidential and congressional power on this. But the other six justices, it's really hard to say. I think that the fact that they essentially kept in place the injunction, in other words, to put it more in plainer English, I mean, they basically kept out of action, kept from taking effect this travel ban as to huge bunches of people, probably most of the people that it affected most directly. That actually just signals that they're willing to take a strong look at this. But it's always been an issue about the balancing national security and essentially whether immigration policy hurts people and whether constitutional rights are trampled upon. I should also add that the lower courts in this case were not just worried about the Constitution here. You know, they did say that that there's a problem here, but there may not be a enough of a basis for this ban. Another thing that the courts are really concerned about is the separation of church and state, and whether this was essentially a Muslim ban, or at least directed against Muslims. Or
right, and did this, I wanted to ask that next. Did the Supreme Court give an indication of what they thought about that religious discrimination angle?
No, I mean, it's not directly. Not directly. What the court did, though, was very interesting, is it basically it basically said that the ban could not go into effect with regards to huge bunches of people inside the United States. And that's a very interesting thing because it signals to me that the court is really going to take seriously the interests of people in the United States, whether it's citizens or companies or other people who are hurt. And one of the ways that the argument that's being made about how those folks might be hurt is because this is essentially disparaging or disadvantaging a religion of Islam. And so I think that the court's willingness to essentially block the ban in all these cases signals some willingness to look at this. You know, I should also add here that, you know, it's been historically really hard. Our courts have been reluctant to take into account constitutional claims in immigration cases. It's historically been really hard to say the government's keeping me out. The government won't let my relative in, and that's unconstitutional. It's been really hard to say that. And one of the strategies that a lot of challengers, in other words, people who are upset with the immigration decisions of the U.S. government, one of the things that the challengers have often said is, but look at the U.S. citizens who are affected. Look at them. And try to get some traction that way. And the Supreme Court and lower courts have been reluctant to take that view, because if you think about it, I mean, so many people are affected by immigration decisions that opening it up to looking at who would be hurt in the United States, U.S. citizens who are hurt, would really gut the traditional insulation of these immigration decisions from court scrutiny. So the fact that the court was willing to look at exactly, not exactly, but to look and take into account the effect on U.S. citizens, it may signal an opening to look more exactly at what the administration did here. One thing I want to add, too, is that this is completing an earlier thought, that it wasn't just constitutional problems that the lower court saw in this matter. One of the things that especially the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on the West Coast saw is that the president has to follow certain procedures to go through and do the things he did in executive order, and he didn't follow those procedures, and he didn't make those determinations. And so there's a strong argument here that the executive orders, whether or not they're constitutional, they actually violate the statute. And we have to bear in mind here that this is the president acting by executive order within the framework of a structure set up by Congress. And so there's a couple of reasons conceptually why the president might be going beyond his legal power. One is he could violate the Constitution. But the other is that he could be essentially acting in violation of the framework that Congress set out.
Hiroshi Monomura is with us, scholar of immigration and citizenship at UCLA's School of Law. We're looking at the partially reinstated travel ban and the future of President Trump's executive order targeting six majority Muslim countries.
And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of the Supreme Court's decision to reinstate part of President Trump's travel ban? Do you think that banning people who don't have a bona fide relationship with people or entities in the U.S. is a good policy, and the Supreme Court will consider the ban in full in the fall? What do you think that decision should be? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Hiroshi Monomura. He is a scholar of immigration and citizenship at UCLA's School of Law. We're looking at President Trump's travel ban. The U.S. Supreme Court said it would consider the ban this fall after it reinstated parts of it yesterday.
You can join us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What decision are you hoping the Supreme Court comes to on the president's full travel ban? Are you or is your family Muslim or from any of the countries mentioned in the ban? And if you're concerned about national security, tell us if you think whether or not this is something President Trump's order would make America safer with. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Richard on the line in Eau Claire. Richard, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, Richard?
Well, I think that the ban should never have been banned in the first place. I think President Trump was on the right track, and he's thinking more of the protection of this nation, of its citizens, than he is citizens of other countries. And I think there should be a lot more scrutiny in who we let into this country. After all, I believe the Constitution was written for the citizens of the United States, not for the world.
Richard, thanks a lot for the call. Richard, hitting some of the arguments, of course, that the Trump administration has been making. Hiroshi, the president has, he says, the right to think of national security that overrides the interest in open immigration. Certainly, he would say, and it makes us safer. What do you think of what Richard has to say, Hiroshi?
Well, I mean, you know, of course, national security is very important, but I think the way the caller set this up is to say that the Constitution, as he said, is written for the citizens and not for, I guess, people outside. I forget exactly how he phrased it. And so, you know, even if you take that to be true, and there is a lot of there's a fair amount of truth to that. The way the court resolved this, at least temporarily, takes into account the rights of U.S. citizens. In other words, you've got U.S. citizens who have family members, for example, in these six countries. You've got U.S. citizens who don't have family members in those countries. And so what the court is really doing is taking into account and saying, okay, the Constitution is for citizens, but some of those citizens have some real close family members they've been waiting to petition for, sponsor for a number of years. And so I don't think it's a question of sort of immigrants or all these folks are outside and they're all trying to get in and that we are just trying to keep them out. I think that there's a balancing here between a number of things, citizens who have particular interests in bringing in family members, citizens who don't. And then the other things here is how much we're going to go. I think the court's very concerned, certainly lower court's very concerned, with how much in making that calculus between national security and constitutional rights, how much we err so much on the side of national security that we start lumping people into groups based on religion or race or ethnicity. I think that the country has a long history of discrimination in the context of immigration. I think that that casts a shadow over what the court is trying to do. One example of that, and just one of many examples, is Japanese internment during World War II, which essentially said, well, you know, we don't really care about the rights of U.S. citizens of Japanese ancestry. So I think the caller makes a point that I think I understand where it's coming from, but I think we've got to think about the fact that this country has all kinds of citizens and interests with regard to immigration, and that's true for all the universities. That's true for companies that are wanting to hire U.S. citizens as well.
Thanks for the call, Richard. We'll go next to Abraham in Green Bay. Abraham, hi.
Hi. I am an American citizen today, and when I came to this country, I came as a 13-year-old refugee born in Kenya. I did not have at the time any bona fide relationships or connections in the United States. I'm involved in the local community here and at the university. I'm a full-time employee of a local employer here. And I'm fully contributing to this country and this society today. And this idea that you must have some form of, you know, connection, specifically a bona fide connection, I think is very detrimental to the very American idea that everyone in this country the very American idea that this country is a country of hope and of liberty and freedom. I mean, we were gifted the Statue of Liberty with incredible writings as a symbol of hope for not only Europe but also the whole world, and we serve as one today.
Abraham, thanks for the call. And Abraham worried there, Hiroshi, that maybe his counterpart in one of those six countries might not get the opportunity he did.
Well, I mean, I essentially agree with what he was saying from the perspective as who is hurt. In the following sense, that I can see why the court went to this bona fide relationship with the U.S. entity or person. I can see why they did that, because they're really trying to balance, you know, what they're going to do while this case is being argued, and they're trying to figure out what do we do right now until we can come up with a final decision. So in that sense, they're balancing. But I think that one of the things that I'm concerned with, and I suppose I share your caller's view on this, is that there are a lot of people who are hurt by the full travel ban who wouldn't be able to show a bona fide relationship with the United States. I think that there's a strong argument that this is associated enough with the president's statements, both during the campaign but also around the time he took office, suggesting that it's targeting a religion. And so if that's the case, then it's going to be then I think that it hurts people who are really going to be hurt by anything that's directed against that religion. So, but I want to point out just the fact that the court took this test on the bona fide relationship now in terms of balancing what to do in the interim. It may or may not have implications for what the court's going to do ultimately. I mean, the court may decide that was the way they're going to maintain the status quo, But they're going to come up with a different decision when it really comes down to deciding this finally. And I'm sure it doesn't take a crystal ball to say this is going to be a close case.
Abraham, thanks for the call. Briefly, I want to get into another argument from the Trump administration that Syria and the other countries on the list, part of the problem they say is we can't get enough information from those countries to do an appropriate background check. That's part of why we need to put off refugees and immigrants and visitors coming from those countries. What's your take on that as we start to wrap up?
Well, a couple things. One is that the refugees, if you're focusing on refugees, but really throughout the whole process, there's been talk of extreme vetting. There's been extreme vetting going on for a very long time. It takes several years of multiple background checks to get in. And so this is apparently something that's been happening for some time. So that's one. The other is another subtle point about the Supreme Court decision. What the order will end up doing, and this will go into effect, is there'll be a review conducted of the vetting procedures. And so, you know, that review may end up becoming conducted, and the order would end up essentially expiring in late September. And if that's the case, then the case will actually go away. It'll be moot, as lawyers say, and there won't be a case for the court to decide. And that's actually one of the issues that the court asked the parties to brief. In other words, is there even going to be a case when you get to October? And it's possible that there'll be a new version of some type of travel ban. It could also be that we're going to move to a completely different approach, which is to rely essentially on what the president's called extreme vetting. And so that's another uncertainty here.
Hiroshi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Hiroshi Motomura. He's a professor at UCLA's School of Law. He focuses on immigration and citizenship. He joined us for a look at the future of the president's travel ban after the U.S. Supreme Court reinstated parts of it yesterday.